We're going to now go back to, as Dave mentioned, talking about some of the other folks who helped out with the arms shipments and who developed downturns in their health and their legal situations. The article that we're going to read right here is from the San Jose Mercury News for Friday, January 23rd of 1987. The headline, Special Prosecutor Looks into San Jose Man's Case. The article is by Pete Carey of the Mercury News Washington Bureau. Investigators for the Iran Special Prosecutor's Office are reviewing a claim by a convicted weapons dealer now in federal prison that he was enticed into selling tanks and jets to Iran by a U.S. Army officer based in Europe. Paul Cutter, age 49, of San Jose, who is serving a five-year sentence in Arizona, said Army Colonel Mark Broman told him in late 1983 and early 1984 that the company they set up together to sell weapons to Iran would operate on behalf of the U.S. government. Broman was then chief of the Pentagon's Office of Defense Cooperation in Paris before retiring in June of 1984. The U.S. Embassy in Paris said it has found nothing to support Cutter's claim. A Defense Department investigation of misconduct involving Broman's activities is under review to see if it should be turned over to the Justice Department. Cutter, also known as Paul Sklocha, which is spelled S-J-E-K-L-O-C-H-A, said the company he and Broman formed received communications from the Defense Department. Quote, "The traffic coming from the Pentagon was immense," he said. He also said that two undersecretaries of defense, whom he refused to identify, knew of the company's activities. The FBI team assisting Iran Independent Counsel Lawrence E. Walsh plans to review Cutter's case and may interview him in prison at Safford, Arizona, according to an agent with the team. If there is evidence to back his claim, the case will be referred to Walsh for action, the agent said, skipping down. A spokesman for the U.S. Embassy in Paris confirmed that Broman headed the Office of Defense Cooperation from 1979 to his retirement on June 30, 1984.
Now, one of the things to speculate about, obviously, is with the Office of Defense Coordination, whether that is, was in any way related to the Paris shooting death of Glenn Suham. Food for thought, grounds for further research. This is one of the speculative deaths in this context. Now, a death which almost certainly appears to have been a direct result of the Iran-Contra scandal, but whose source remains something of a mystery, is that of a man named Cyrus Hashemi. We talked about this man in RFA number 31. We're going to review some of the aspects of his death right now. Reading now from the San Jose Mercury News of Saturday, June 13th of 1987. This is an LA Times story, Dateline New York, headlined, Mysterious Death of Iranian Arms Dealer Under Investigation. Congressional committees probing the Iran-Contra scandal are investigating the mysterious death in London last summer of Iranian weapons dealer Cyrus Hashemi, H-A-S-H-E-M-I, who had sought unsuccessfully to become a key middleman in the arms for hostages trade. Sources also say a U.S. government informant who had worked with Hashemi alleges that Customs Service officials told him that the arms dealer may have been bumped off, unquote, by government agents to protect the then-secret Iran initiative. Documents filed in federal court in Washington this week support the accounts by these sources who spoke on condition of anonymity. According to sources in Washington and London, a Senate investigator has made two trips to England to meet with government and medical authorities familiar with the Hashemi case. Hashemi, a rival for roles ultimately assumed by Adnan Khashoggi and Manoucher Gurbanifar in the Iran operation, died suddenly on July 21st, 3 months before the secret arms deals were disclosed. Officially, death was attributed to a rare and virulent form of leukemia that was diagnosed only 2 days before Hashemi died. Since then, persistent questions have been raised about the accuracy of these autopsy results or whether chemical or radiation injections or sprays could have caused similar symptoms. There are lots of sophisticated methods of assassination these days, a committee source said. Given all the circumstances, we'd be ignoring our responsibility if we didn't follow up what is, at the very least, a mysterious death of an important link, unquote, in the Iran arms affair. At the time of his death, the 47-year-old Hashemi was acting as a confidential customs informant in a $2.5 billion sting operation that led to the arrests of a retired Israeli general and two Khashoggi business associates. Their case is pending. A customs official, while expressing skepticism about suggestions of exotic foul play in the death, conceded this week, a mystery writer couldn't have done better, unquote. Hashemi first emerged as a controversial character in early attempts at clandestine relations between the United States and the revolutionary government of Iran. In 1980, after 52 hostages were seized at the U.S. Embassy in Tehran, Hashemi, who was based in London, offered to help negotiate for their release. He claimed to be a cousin of Hashemi Rafsanjani, now leader of the Iranian parliament, recalled Lloyd Cutler, legal counsel to President Carter at the time. We met with him in New York, but nothing important came of it. Hashemi did, however, open contacts with officials in Tehran and went on to use those contacts to sell U.S. arms to Iran in 1981 and 1982. He and two of his brothers were indicted in 1984 for their roles in those transactions. One went to jail, but Hashemi and the other brother fled back to England, claiming the sales were part of their effort to open channels necessary to help get hostages released. Well, obviously, this article suggests a motive for the assassination, if indeed it was an assassination of Cyrus Hashemi, that he was putting the sting on the Iranian arms situation, that he was a rival of some of the people who were involved in it. It's worth remembering that an as yet unnamed Iranian approached the October surprise group put together by the Reagan campaign team and formed a contact which, according to a number of sources, including Alfonso Chardy of the Miami Herald, basically resulted in a deal between the Reagan campaign and the Iranian regime to withhold the hostages until after the election, thereby deep-sixing Jimmy Carter's electoral possibilities. That's worth thinking about. Also worth thinking about is the association in that Iranian arms, those Iranian arms transactions between Cyrus Hashemi and a man named J. Stanley Pottinger, himself a man with close ties to George Bush, as we looked at in RFA number 31. It was 30 and 31. We took a look at the Pottinger-Bush connection, and in number 31, we looked at the Pottinger-Hashemi connection. And remember, J. Stanley Pottinger, not only close to George Bush, one of the central players here, but also involved apparently in the cover-up of the assassination of Orlando Letelier, one of the many Corru-related crimes that ties in with the anti-Castro CIA and mafia-related Cuban milieu that we talked about in RFAs 26, 27, 29, 30 and 29 and 30.
A lot of numbers to remember. We're going to look at an article from the London Observer of August 3rd, 1986 to get a little more detail on the rather rapid and unexpected passing of Cyrus Hashemi, although shouldn't say unexpected, because any time apparently you start giving information on this thing, your passing should be shortly expected, at least according to the stuff that we've been looking at. The article is by Patrick Seal and goes like this. Dr. Cyrus Hashemi, star witness in what is described as, quote, the largest arms conspiracy in American history, unquote, died in a London hospital on July 21st after a brief and mysterious illness. His brother, Mr. Muhammad Ali Hashemi, said last week, quote, I believe my brother was murdered. I will pursue the killers and bring them to justice even if it takes the rest of my life, unquote. By his own admission, Dr. Hashemi cooperated with the U.S. government earlier this year in foiling the illegal sale to Iran of some $2.5 billion of American weapons. By duping a number of arms traders into believing that he was an authorized agent of Iran, he led them into a trap sprung by U.S. Customs and the Justice Department. Skipping down. More than half the total package, about $1.4 billion worth, was to have been supplied from Israeli stockpiles. An Israeli reserve general and two of the country's leading arms dealers were among the group indicted. Although the Israeli government denied involvement in the affair, arms dealers assert that the procurement of false end-user certificates and the shipment of such vast quantities of arms could not have been arranged without the approval of government agencies. We want to go all the way
down to there and then down to there.
Okay, we're already down to there, so skip there. Okay, skipping down to a little bit more about Cyrus Hashemi's death. When it was established that there was nothing wrong with his heart, he was taken to the hospital because he was having apparent heart problems, and he collapsed. When it was established that there was nothing wrong with Dr. Hashemi's heart, he was moved to the hospital's neurological department. Bone marrow tests indicated that he was suffering from leukemia. Treatment started on July 19th, but 2 days later he was dead. The death certificate put the cause of death as accidental brainstem damage due to a stroke and leukemia. The post-mortem, at which a U.S. customs official is understood to have been present, specified the death was caused by, quote, acute myeloblastic leukemia. According to Muhammad Ali Hashemi, however, it is possible to introduce toxic substances into the body by spray, drink, or injection, which produce symptoms similar to leukemia, and cause death. Quote, certain Middle East intelligence services are known to use this method. he claimed. Certain North American intelligence services, as we mentioned at the beginning of the broadcast, are also known to have a fairly replete bag of tricks in the natural death or seemingly natural death department.
Now, one more article we're going to look at before we take a break. This person appears to have enjoyed somewhat better luck than people like Cyrus Hashemi, but still, this is a key person who helped blow the lid on the whole Iran-Contragate scandal, and he was very lucky to escape with his life because he was shot just a few weeks ago, as a matter of fact. Reading now from the San Francisco Chronicle of September 15th, 1987. This is an AP story, Dateline Beirut, headlined, Man Who Revealed Iran Deal Is Shot. The Lebanese journalist who first publicized the secret U.S. arms sales to Iran was shot and wounded yesterday by a gunman riding a motorcycle. A doctor said Hassan Sabra, S-A-B-R-A, publisher and editor of the Beirut weekly magazine Al-Shira, may have been blinded by the gunfire. Sabra, 38, suffered four bullet wounds in the head, neck, and chest from the assassination attempt. Quote, He is in stable condition but might lose his eyesight from the head wound, said one doctor at the American University Hospital as Sabra emerged from 3 hours of surgery to remove the bullets. The doctor spoke on condition of anonymity. Sabra, a Shiite Muslim, made enemies through his reporting in Al-Shara on Iranian politics and the foreign hostages held in Lebanon. So this is an individual who is not dead, but who is very lucky to have escaped what apparently a lot of other people in this case did not escape.
Certainly the people who delivered that message to him were not intending that he should live through it. Okay, well, we're going to take a break before we come back for the final, probably just about an hour of Radio Free America this evening. So get up, stretch. Those of you who are listening to the whole thing, congratulations on your marathon endurance. An hour to go. Get up and run around a little bit. And Dave Emery and myself, Nip Tuck, we will return in just...
Yeah, indeed. Now, the... quote, leukemia death, if indeed that's what it was, of Cyrus Hashemi, is going to act as a bridge into some speculative deaths concerning the Iran-Contra scandal. We're going to take a look now at the deaths of conservative fundraiser Terry Dolan and the impending death of Billy Carter, the president, the brother of President Jimmy Carter. Billy is apparently has a case of terminal cancer of the pancreas, and we're going to take a look at these deaths in the context of the Iran-Contra scandal.
Okay, the first one here is an article from the, I'm losing my mind here, what is it, the Washington Post,
right,
for Thursday, December 18th, 1986. This was provided to us by Mae Russell, and the article is headlined, Tax Election Law Questions Arise on Activists' Pro-Contra Efforts, and it's under the heading of the Reagan Administration's Secret Arms Deal, and the article is by Thomas B. Edsall, E-D-S-A-L-L, Washington Post staff writer. Carl Russell Spitz Channel, the head of a network of conservative organizations, may have avoided involvement in a potentially major scandal, but now he may face a series of investigations. Earlier this week, Channel denied charges that he had received money skimmed from Iranian arms sales to finance lobbying in support of the Nicaraguan Contras and political campaigns against Democratic opponents of Contra aid. At the same time, however, he publicly acknowledged activities that now appear certain to bring investigations by the Internal Revenue Service, Congress, and the Federal Election Commission. In Congress, the House Ways and Means Committee is expected to initiate a broad inquiry into the legality of the use of foundations by politically active individuals and groups. Foundations have become increasingly attractive because donors are allowed to take tax deductions for their contributions, and there are no restrictions on the amount or source of the money the foundations receive or spend, unlike with political action committees, which are severely restricted in this area. Channel, a well-financed conservative fundraiser, conducted a series of political and lobbying programs in support of aid to the Nicaraguan counter-revolutionaries over the past year that raised questions about the tax and election law issues involving four groups. Last Sunday, the Lowell, Massachusetts Sun charged that one of Channel's groups, the National Endowment for the Preservation of Liberty, received money skimmed from the profits of arms sales to Iran, skipping to the end of the article. Channel, age 41, served as finance chairman of the National Conservative Political Action Committee, NCPAC, from 1979 to 1983. He is also head of Western Goals and Western Goals Foundation, two organizations founded by the late Representative Larry McDonald, Democrat of Georgia, the former John Birch Society leader who was aboard Korean Airlines Flight 007, shot down by the Soviet Union. And it also mentions that Merrill Lee Schwartz contributed to this report. So Spitz Channel himself is not dead, but Spitz Channel's involvement with some political organizations is interesting in view of his extremely deep involvement in many of the illicit activities of the Iran-Contra case.
Now, one of the things that Spitz Channel was, he was very much involved with the National Conservative Political Action Committee. Shortly after the Iran-Contra scandal broke, in fact, a month later, the head of that particular organization died, ostensibly of AIDS, which in and of itself is intriguing. We've devoted our longest single archive program to an in-depth study of AIDS as a biological warfare weapon. It is our contention that, in all probability, AIDS is, in fact, the first serious application of genetic engineering to biological warfare. Even, however, if it was not AIDS, and certainly we've seen people dying of some strange things in this particular case, witness Cyrus Hashemi. We're going to take a look shortly at Billy Carter and also William Casey, who died, one is dying of and one ostensibly died of cancer. It's worth speculating on the death of John Terrence Dolan against the background of the National Conservative Political Action Committee and the spotlight trained on that organization as a result of Spitz Channel's involvement in the Iran-Contra scandal. Reading from the San Francisco Chronicle of Wednesday, December 31st of 1986, a Washington Post story datelined Washington headlined, Conservative fundraiser Dolan dies. John Terrence Terry Dolan, co-founder of the National Conservative Political Action Committee, an influential organization that supported conservatives and financed campaigns against liberal candidates for national office, died of congestive heart failure Sunday at age 36. He had acquired immune deficiency syndrome, sources told the Washington Post. Dolan was among the first to recognize the significance of court interpretations of post-Watergate election spending regulations. These place no limit on the amount of money an independent organization or individual could spend on a political campaign, provided there was no direct affiliation with the candidate. He helped found the National Conservative Political Action Committee in 1975, quote, to promote the election of conservative candidates to Congress, unquote, and he was president of the organization until about 6 months ago. Well, whether or not his congestive heart failure was indeed produced by AIDS, again, his death at this time is interesting to take note of, food for thought and grounds for further research. Maybe no connection to the Iran-Contra scandal, but with Spitz Channel in the spotlight and Spitz Channel having pleaded guilty, it's interesting to think about, and we would like to know more about that particular death.
That's right, and the Spitz Channel case is only, again, to probably beat the iceberg metaphor into the ground. It's only one small part. The Reagan administration put together or utilized an incredible array of interlocking foundations and political action committees and covert operations and things like that to fund their not only the Iran-Contra stuff but all of their political activities that were anti or unconstitutional. So who knows how deep that goes, and some of the other deaths that may be coincidental, but who knows how central to some of these operations some of these other people were. Terry Dolan, for example. Okay, we're going to read a short segment of an article here from the San Francisco Chronicle for Saturday, September 12, 1987. The headline, Billy Carter Has Inoperable Cancer. It's an AP Wire story, Dateline Atlanta. Billy Carter, brother of former President Jimmy Carter, has inoperable cancer of the pancreas, the same disease that killed his father and his sister, the doctor said yesterday. Quote, the prognosis is poor, said Dr. R. Martin York, a cancer specialist at Emory University Hospital, and Billy Carter's attending physician. Again, Billy Carter in much the same situation as some of the other people we've talked about. Yes, he does have pancreatic cancer, which apparently has run in the family. However, Billy Carter is significant to the case for a variety of reasons, not least of which being the key role that his Libyan connections played in, as we mentioned before, the deep-sixing of the Carter presidency. And the deeper we get into the Iran case, we mentioned about Iran, the Iran-Contra scandal being only a very insignificant portion of the great whole. The Iran case seems to be only, well, let's find a new metaphor, only the frosting on the cake itself being perhaps the deep-sixing of the Carter presidency and the virtual theft of the White House by the Reagan people before they were a Reagan administration, when they were the Reagan campaign team. And Billy Carter's misadventures in Libya played a very important part in that.
Now, one of the key names in connection with the so-called Billygate affair, in which Billy Carter was found to have business dealings with officials of Muammar Gaddafi's Libya, was none other than Michael Adine. Ladin. We took a look at Ladin's involvement in Iran-Contragate in Radio Free America number 30. He also is part of not only the Triple Wilson team, but has been part of the terrorism experts, quote-unquote, that have basically skewered the Reagan administration's portrayal of world terrorism in a 180-degree at a 180-degree angle of variance with the truth. That's what I mean to say. Basically, Michael Ladin, along with such stalwarts as John Barron, editor-in-chief of the Reader's Digest and a man with long-standing ties to the CIA, and Claire Sterling, have been beating the drum concerning the Soviet Union as the evil empire and specifically the epicenter of world terrorism. As we've looked at in any number of Radio Free America broadcasts, number 4 coming to mind right offhand, numbers 18 through 21 about the Mediterranean merry-go-round, Radio Free America number 22 and number 23, so many of the terrorist incidents that have plagued the world in the last 20 years, while having been blamed on either the Soviet Union or leftist Palestinian elements, and in fact many of them used sincere Palestinian nationalist dupes, I guess one could say, at the operational level. When you look at the executive level, the puppet masters, so to speak, one finds NATO intelligence and, more often than not, our own national security establishment. We've gone into the Triple Wilson financing and arming of Gaddafi at great length. Michael Ladin is one of these people who keeps portraying the actions of U.S. and NATO-sponsored terrorists as actions of the Soviet Union, thereby lending the proper political context to what appear to be political provocations, terrorist incidents set up to generate a reaction in the opposite direction. Now, Michael Ladin was very much involved with Arno de Borgrav in breaking a story in the New Republic on Billy Carter's dealings with Libya. Incidentally, the name Robert Vesco crops up in connection with Billy Gate. We'll talk about that in our next broadcast at greater length. The point being here that a number of things were done to destabilize the Carter administration. The Billy Gate affair, in which Ladin and de Borgrav worked with Francesco Pazienza and the P2 boys. Check out RFAs number 17 through 21 for greater detail on that. And in addition, we took a look at how the hostage crisis itself was strange, with the Kissinger-Rockefeller instigation of the admitting of the Shah to the United States, the deep-sixing of the Desert One rescue mission, the putting together of the October surprise group in order to trash Jimmy Carter's chances of getting reelected, and how that whole October surprise group eventually emerged into a martial law cabal around the Rex 84 plant. This is the context in which to look at the Billy Carter affair.
Again, to underscore Dave's point, which I think is very important, the 180-degree swivel of the truth as performed by people like Michael Ladin, Claire Sterling, Arno de Borgrav, Robert Moss, John Barron et al., in that one of the main reasons, if not the main reason, that people like Ladin and Pazienza knew about Billy Carter's contacts with the Libyan government was because the Italian and American governments themselves, the intelligence sectors of both governments, were so heavily involved with Gaddafi's government that they could not help but know this. We've talked at great length about Ed Wilson and Frank Turpel. We've also talked and their involvement with Muammar Gaddafi. We've also talked about the Italians involved in the International Fascista, the parts of the P2 empire and others involved in the International Fascista, and Muammar Gaddafi's bankrolling alongside Otto Skorzeny of the Paladin Group, another right-wing mercenary group that has been involved with both Italian and American intelligence. So again, it's the particular perfidy of these people that somebody like Michael Ladin can, on one hand, run in and try and fake a Bulgarian connection, literally change evidence in an attempted murder case of the highest international priority, that being that of the attempt on Pope John Paul II, and then turn around the next day and impudently suggest that, in fact, it's the Soviet Union or the Bulgarians that are involved. So these people are not only lying about the news, but in many cases they're actively involved in the crimes themselves, a point that should not be overlooked.
Now, one of the major players in the Iran-Contra situation, one of the major cogs in this particular set of wheels, was none other than the late CIA director William Casey. We're going to take a look at a couple of articles, and we're going to juxtapose them very quickly, and I think the movement vis-a-vis William Casey will become very, very evident. Reading now from the New York Times of Tuesday, July 14th of 1987. This is an article by Fox Butterfield of the New York Times. Headlined, Casey had Fall Guy plan as early as 84... North says. Again, Dateline Washington. Lieutenant Colonel Oliver L. North said today that the plan to make him the fall guy for the Iran-Contra operations was first suggested by William J. Casey as early as 1984, when the White House began its secret support for the Nicaraguan rebels. Colonel North had previously emphasized conversations he said he had had with Mr. Casey last fall, as the administration's secret arms sales to Iran and the resupply program for the Contras began to become public, about making the colonel the scapegoat. Mr. Casey, who resigned as director of Central Intelligence in February, died in May. Just contrast that with the call of the headline and article Nip's about to read you.
All right, and the article that we're about to read to you is from the San Francisco Chronicle for Tuesday, December 16th, 1986. Casey taken to hospital, seizures. Dateline Washington. CIA Director William Casey was hospitalized yesterday after suffering, quote, a minor cerebral seizure while conferring with his aides in his office, spokesman at Georgetown University Hospital said. Casey, age 73, was taken by ambulance from CIA headquarters in Langley, Virginia, just before noon, and he suffered a second seizure while he was in the radiology department, according to Dr. Jack Stapleton, medical director of the hospital. Casey had been scheduled to testify today before the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence on the secret sale of weapons to Iran, but Stapleton said it was clear that Casey would not appear. And, of course, as we know, with the clarity of hindsight that was not had in December of 1986, Casey not only did not testify, he didn't live a whole lot longer.
Right, and it's interesting to contemplate a couple of things here. Also, reflecting on the death of Billy Carter, one of the things that we've talked about on this program for years, and something which is included in an archive show that we did on accuracy in media and their attack on us, concerns the fact that the U.S. national security establishment, specifically the CIA, had perfected a means of giving people cancer as early as 1954. So assassination by cancer is a reality in calendar year 1987, has been for 30 years or more.
And we might also just remember that Cyrus Hashemi, who had been checked, I believe it was some 3 months earlier, or maybe even less than that, by a team of Swiss doctors and pronounced absolutely clean, including blood tests, got a seizure one day while standing around talking to an American business partner and was dead within 2 days from leukemia, which is normally a disease that has been diagnosed long before it eventually claims its victim. So we're not only talking about the ability to give the possibility of the ability to give some kind of cancer to people, but the ability to give them a very fast-acting or galloping cancer indeed.
Now, reflect also on William Casey's plan to have Oliver North be the fall guy. Just before William Casey was going to testify, he has a seizure. He is then not heard from again for all practical purposes and dies ostensibly of cancer, quite possibly of cancer. We don't know. We'll never know. Following story is from the San Francisco Chronicle of Monday, July 20th of 1987. It's a UPI story, Dateline Washington, headlined, Casey Death Probes Reported. Suspicious senators kept close tabs on dying former CIA Chief William Casey, monitoring medical reports and the results of an autopsy to confirm he died of natural causes, U.S. News and World Report reported. A CIA spokeswoman, Kathy Ferson, dismissed the report as pretty disgusting, unquote. After Casey's death May 6th, according to one of two highly placed congressional sources, unquote, quoted by the magazine, unidentified Senate Intelligence Committee members obtained autopsy information because they were, quote, wary of possible deception, unquote, and wanted to be certain the nation's top spy died of natural causes. The magazine, in its edition Saturday, said members of another but unnamed Senate committee also took part in the death watch. Skipping down on the article, the spy chief became a center of controversy because of his role in the clandestine U.S. sale of arms to Iran and allegations he knew some of the profits were being diverted to Nicaraguan rebels. Casey testified before three congressional committees investigating the Iran-Contra scandal and was scheduled for additional appearances when he suffered a pair of seizures December 15, 1986, at his CIA office in Langley, Virginia. 3 days later, he underwent brain cancer surgery and was hospitalized until mid-February. He returned to the hospital for more treatment in mid-March, but never returned to Capitol Hill to testify on the scandal. Rest in peace, William Casey. Apparently, our suspicions concerning William Casey's death were shared by quite a few other people, including cartoonist Gary Trudeau of Doonesbury fame. The point being here that, as the old adage says, one who digs a pit for another often falls in himself. Apparently someone else had a fall guy plan for the Iran-Contra scandal, and it apparently upstaged William Casey's fall guy plan. If Oliver North was a fall guy, what does that make William Casey?
A fallen guy. We're going to read about another victim of the Iran-Contra hearings, or apparently another victim. The article is from the New York Times for Tuesday, December 2nd, 1986. This particular victim was not allowed the luxury of dying in a hospital bed. The headline is, an upstate murder in 1983 is reported linked to Iran arms smuggling. By the way, again, note December 2nd, 1986. This is, again, as with many of our other deaths that we've been talking about tonight, something that took place within about a month of the national breaking of
the story.
Actually,
this particular guy, though, did die in 1983.
He had died before, yes, but this particular story, you're right, came out right after that. What was it? Oh, an upstate murder in 1983 was reported linked to Iran arms smuggling. The article is by Ralph Blumenthal. A slain businessman whose body was found in a Bear Mountain, New York lake in 1983 was apparently involved in procuring contraband arms for Iran, a former state police investigator said yesterday. The victim, George M. Perry, a 64-year-old former General Motors executive with business dealings in Europe and South America, was found with 3 bullet holes in his head and weights attached to his legs in Lake Tayarati on April 8, 1983, 3 months after vanishing from the Grand Hyatt Hotel in New York. The state police officer, Thomas Starace, I'm not sure how it's pronounced, S-T-R-A-C-E, we'll say Starace. The state police officer, Thomas Starace, who recently retired, was one of 12 investigators originally assigned to the still open case. He said the inquiry had uncovered links to arms trading for Iran. He said in an interview that Mr. Perry appeared to have been involved with a group of Czechoslovaks and Brazilians dealing in tanks and arms parts, and that at one point $20 million allocated for the purchases disappeared. Quote, somebody did not want to give the money back, Mr. Starace said, adding that whoever had, quote, fronted or advanced the money might have blamed Mr. Perry for its disappearance. He said it was not clear whether Mr. Perry had control of the money and could have returned it. A 1983 article in the New York Times noted that Mr. Perry, like many American executives working abroad, had been routinely debriefed about his observations by the Central Intelligence Agency. Mr. Starace said state police investigators had sought the cooperation of the CIA in their inquiry. Quote, the CIA would not cooperate with us at all, he said. It would not return our calls at all. He said the State Department had also offered no cooperation when investigators tried to go to Brazil to interview witnesses. The Brazilian government declined to grant visas on the ground that it did not want its citizens harassed, and the State Department declined to intercede, he said. Mr. Starace, who now runs a detective agency in Cornwall, New York, said a key clue in the case was the cropping up of Mr. Perry's name in a taped conversation between an undercover agent and suspected arms smugglers during an investigation in Pennsylvania in 1983, several months after the murder. He said one of the participants warned another to be careful, at the risk of winding up like Mr. Perry. Mr. Starace said that suspicion for the murder fell on a group of Czechoslovaks living in New York, but that not enough evidence had been compiled for arrests. The former police officer said he was not in possession of the latest information, but believed no new data had emerged for about 2 years. A state police spokesman at the Palisades substation voiced irritation yesterday with Mr. Starace's disclosures, saying that the case was still under investigation. Mr. Starace's comments were originally reported yesterday by the Gannett chain of Westchester Rockland newspapers.
So whether George Perry's name is to be added to the list remains to be seen, but it certainly doesn't seem at all unlikely. Now, the next suspicious death that we're going to deal with here is going to act as a transition to the last section of our broadcast this evening. We're going to take a look at the curious death of a person who was involved in the Christic Institute suit. And for that, we're not going to read. We're going to go to a tape of a talk that Dan Sheehan gave. This was broadcast over sister station KPFA in Berkeley on the evening of October 6th of 1987, and we received permission from the management of that station to use this particular material. This is a talk by Danny Sheehan, and again, credit for this goes to sister station KPFA in Berkeley, who broadcast this on October 6th, and it, through their permission, we are going to broadcast a short segment of it. Now, the person you're going to be hearing here is Dan Sheehan, chief counsel of the Christic Institute.
A more recent party, who will have to remain nameless temporarily, was in the process of providing documents to us demonstrating the evidence between Theodore Shackley and Edwin Wilson and Tom Clines during a period of assassination programs in Iran. 2 days prior to his meeting with us to provide the documents, he was in bed reading with his wife and simply stopped breathing. Stopped breathing. They couldn't figure out what was happening, and his heart stopped several minutes later. He was a veteran of the Central Intelligence Agency, and his wife was determined that there would be no autopsy on him. We dispatched private investigators to his office immediately upon hearing of his death to secure the documents, only to find that the office had been penetrated, the burglar alarms were going off, and a search of the office has not turned up even the duplicates of the documents that we've already been given. And that investigation is pending at the
present. That document was pending at the time that Daniel Sheehan was giving that talk, originally aired on KPFA. Again, now, as Dave mentioned, a sort of a transition, the unnamed CIA agent, the death of a key witness, of course, in the Christic Institute's preparation of their suit against the National Security Establishment and the, quote, secret team, unquote. But also the interesting pattern of the death of the witness and the penetration of the witness's office or repository and the disappearance of valuable papers. Of course, one of the major keynotes of the Watergate case was the work of the plumbers doing things like burglarizing Daniel Ellsberg's psychiatrist's office and carrying on a variety of break-ins in many, many places. This has, in fact, highlighted the Iran-Contra case and the Reagan administration's pursuit of their enemies almost virtually since the administration began, but particularly with emphasis to their Central American policies.
Mm-hmm. Now, the last five items we're going to read here, again, Sheehan tape served as a sort of a transition. Obviously, we're taking a look there front and center at the very strange death of the former CIA man who had been providing the Christic Institute with information. It's also intriguing that that burglary took place because that is a pattern that has obtained throughout the course of the investigation into and cover-up of the Iran-Contra scandal.